So first request is please do send me your email in the chat, just so that we always keep kind of a running tally of how many people are coming and who's coming. And I never turn those lists over to the FBI at all. Never. But please do. And so that is quite helpful. Let me tell you about what we have coming up. And first of all, thanks to a lot of the people who are on the screen for attending the With Babies and Banners last night from the DC Labor Fest. And that was an old home week in a variety of ways. Great piece of film, as many people said last night, that really stands the test of time since it was made in 1978. And so it's really worthwhile. Well, in February, we have one thing already set, and I believe the other one will be in February. We just don't have a date yet. But Alex Fleet is at Wayne State University, works with Liz Pfau, and has been looking at issues of welfare capitalism. And so he's going to be doing a presentation basically about 10 days from now on Americanization, industrial democracy, and the rubber industry, welfare capitalism, and company unionism at the Goodyear Rubber and Tire Company. I think it'll be fascinating. This period, the kind of ways that they attempted to use company unions to resist unionization during the rise of the CIO is really fascinating stuff. So I commend that to you. Then look for my emails because Jason Kozlowski recently moved from being a professor at West Virginia to a teacher in the New York public school system. And I think that that's really a brave move in a lot of ways. But he's going to be doing a presentation called Hemmed In, Deindustrialization and Its Discontents in Western New York, basically the Buffalo area, 1990 to 2019, looking at a place called New Era Cap Company that does baseball caps for a lot of the major sports. And all of our stuff this spring is on Zoom. So please do come to those and do send me your email in the chat. Now I have to tell you about today's brown bag and you know, the problem, it doesn't translate well because it reverses everything, but this is Jack's book and I really commend it to you. The book, Bridging the Divide, Working Class Culture and Middle Class Society, came out from ILR Press at Cornell in November of 21. So very, very recent. And it's been my absolute pleasure. I was thinking of this, Jack, this morning to get ready for this. And I'm not going to tell all those stories. But what I will say is that I think that I first met you in the early 1980s. So that it's been a long time. You might not remember that, but we can talk about that later if I'm wrong.
I do remember that. It was very memorable.
Those charges were dropped. We won't even mention that. Jack Metzger has been one of the major boilerplate people who has really helped create the Working Class Studies Association. And with Sherry Lincoln, John Russo and others, has created one of the finest transdisciplinary fields that one can be connected to, because you can be on a panel with a working artist on the one side of you, of sociologists from Finland on the other, and you have just unbelievable conversations. But beyond all that, Jack is one of the nicest single people that you're ever going to meet. And the book is really, I love the fact that he'll be the first to say, this is not a memoir. And he'll say instead, perhaps, that this is a rumination on what the period that many of us traveled through, the kind of the glorious 30, from the 1945 period through 1975, and the kind of settled working class culture that is a real hallmark of that period, at the same time that there was a rise of this notion that somehow all of us were becoming middle class. So today, Jack is going to talk about his book. He'll talk for a while, and then we're going to open it up for discussion. So please do mute at least temporarily until we tell you not to. And he's going to be using the going after the colon for the purpose of today's talk, working class culture in a middle class society. So please help me welcome to our daily work, our daily lives, Jack Metzger.
Okay. Thanks everybody for coming. And John, thanks for making me part of the brown bag. I'm going to talk about the major themes of the book, kind of lay them out. Probably, you said about 30 minutes, right, John?
Oh, 30 to 45 is fine.
Oh, and then, don't say
so we'll
that.
Open it up. We'll open it up for questions and comments whenever you're ready.
Okay.
And cool. Not right now.
Okay. The book is an interpretation of what I claim are the two major class cultures in U.S. society. And that is the culture of the professional middle class, which is seen, and by professional middle class, I define that by professional workers and managerial workers. That group of people usually have college degrees, usually have a decent income. And then the other culture is the culture of the working class, which is everybody who isn't a professional or managerial worker. It's a very rough kind of definition, but it will serve. And the paradox here is that professional middle-class culture sees itself as the mainstream and is seen generally as the mainstream culture. And working-class culture, I contend, is the culture that the majority of people, and possibly the vast majority of people, including many middle-class professionals, actually live in a culture more similar to the working class than to the middle class professionalism. So the book is going to stand or fall on the interpretation of these two cultures, whether it's too rigid, whether it's a overgeneralization, whether it's true or not, or whether it's insightful. And I'll give you a thumbnail sketch. There's a lot of development and illustration, of course, in the book. But professional middle class culture emphasizes aspiration, achievement, and becoming. And it has a very dynamic sense of self, that the self is something that can be and should be improved and even transformed over time. Working class culture, conversely, emphasizes authenticity, character, and belonging, and has a more restricted sense of self, often a sense that there is a true self to which you should be true to. And that's part of the sense of authenticity in working class culture. There are some other differences that I talk about, but those are the main ones. The other ones are that professional middle class envisions life as being lived within a career, whereas working class culture makes a sharper distinction between the job and the rest of life. And the job is sort of necessity and the rest of life is freedom. So that the sharper break, and that has a number of implications. The working class tends to be more parochial and present oriented, and the middle class more cosmopolitan and future oriented. The middle class is more individualistic and much more status conscious, and the working class is anti-status, or at least anti-status hierarchies, and much more comfortable with mutual dependency, that kind of belonging, solidaristic quality. In the book, I try to treat both cultures, and I actually make the argument that both cultures are equally valuable and valid. And so I do not, despite some people who have been reading this, I do not criticize the basics of middle-class culture. I think aspiration, achievement, and becoming, I think those are all good things. I also happen to think that authenticity, character, and belonging are all good things. So the argument is that these are equally valid and valuable cultures. And they're not totally incompatible. I mean, it's possible to both become and belong and to be a good person while accomplishing things. But the cultures push us, nudge us, force us in some ways, depending on our job, to emphasize one over the other. And that gives you somewhat, and in some cases very, different ways of life and ways of conceiving of living a life. I do criticize, but the book, because middle-class culture, professional middle-class culture sees itself as the dominant, justifiably the dominant culture in the mainstream culture. And the culture that by being mainstream, by seeing itself and the society as a whole, seeing middle-class culture as sort of as the mainstream, that means often, most often, that this is the culture that everybody should aspire to and that everybody should be measured by. And I do criticize that notion, the notion that the professional middle class way is the one right way. And that is a very common notion in the professional middle class, and particularly in my profession of in higher education, which a lot of what we're doing is helping people become more like us. And adopting our culture. The other thing I criticize middle-class culture for, again, not the fundamentals of the culture, but for so often, when it pays attention to working-class culture at all, and I do attack or critique scholars who think there is no working-class culture, period, but when they pay attention to working class life and culture at all, middle class culture generally sees the working class as a deficit culture. And by that, I mean that what they see is, ooh, the working class doesn't aspire enough. It doesn't accomplish much and it doesn't even care about accomplishing enough. And it doesn't have this sense of becoming that they could be something that they're not yet. So, and those, I would say, yeah, those are probably compared to middle-class culture. Those are real criticisms of working-class culture, many of which I have worked against as a teacher a good part of my life. But if all you see is the deficits and you don't see that, on the other hand, there's authenticity, character, the emphasis on authenticity, character, and belonging, you don't see the positive qualities or the guts of the culture, then you're going to misunderstand a lot of things, both about that culture, but also about ourselves as a class culture. And I identify as a middle-class professional, so make that be clear. Okay, in the end, I emphasize how the two cultures can have and should complement each other societally and individually, not by becoming more alike, but by simply having more interaction with one another. The way cultures influence one another is not direct, where one culture convincing the other to become more like it, although that happens as well, but really by the interaction and the way each culture helps to offset the other. And that's what I try to show. Now that's pretty abstract, but I developed these ideas within the context of my own life. And it's not a memoir, but I freely draw on my own observation and experience. and the life of my times. So for me, I was born and raised in an extended steelworker family in a steel town in Appalachia, isolated steel town in Appalachia, where we lived in the valley and our betters lived on a hill. And we had very little interaction with them or them with us, except at work, which as kids, we didn't have. They went to a different high school than we went to, et cetera. Or they went to a different set of smaller high schools than ours. So I see that as a very kind of extreme. Now, there's a steelworker occupational culture as well. There's all kinds of different ethnic cultures and gender differences and all of that. But as a class culture, that was a pretty pure version of it, to my mind, a pretty extreme version of it. And then after many, many years, decades actually of education, I've spent the rest of my life in higher education, which is an extreme form or a pure form of professional middle class culture. As I said, part of our job is to advance that culture one person at a time. So that's my life in terms of my person. But looking at history, and I spent a lot of time reading and studying history, and people who know me, American historians who know me, know that I don't know anything prior to 1929. So it's the Depression and forward that interests me. I know there was a Roman Empire back there sometime, but I'm not a professional historian. But that post-war period, I understood and I understand now, and I actually cannot not see this. The 30 years from 1945 to 1975, I was born in 1943. So I was 2 years old when what the French call the Glorious 30 occurred. And that 30 years from 1945 to 1975, I take the whole front part of the book to make this argument, was the best time for any working class anywhere at any time. Now that's a pretty broad, bold statement. And people will argue with me about the last 30 years in China in terms of material well-being. But if you look at the expansion of freedom, and I'll explain what I mean by that, as well as the material prosperity, then these are the best 30 years any working class has ever experienced. Now, then, after I experienced those 30 years, which to me growing up were tumultuous and difficult, and I didn't appreciate them. They didn't seem like a golden age to me as I became an adult. But then in the late 70s and early 80s, in my experience, somewhat outside the range of the Glorious 30, I could see, and I could see in my own family, in my own hometown and in Chicago, it all started falling apart, as almost everybody here knows. And there's been almost a half century now of decline mostly, and stagnation in some ways, but mostly decline. And in some places, like the deindustrialized place that I'm from and still have family there, it's been devastatingly dramatic, particularly as you go through the generations. So to me, that's one, I cannot not see that. But number two, I can't stop myself from insisting that everybody else see it. And that we understand, we try to look hard, get past our nostalgia, or rather adopt a more restorative kind of nostalgia, see this period as a golden age and try to figure out what was gold about it, what we would want to replicate, and how we could replicate those things. The book answers those questions in not so much on the policy side, although it has a policy outline, but by locating what was gold and what was glorious about the glorious 30. So I've got to sort of make that case, and this is sort of focused just on one chapter, but there's four chapters in the book, in the front part of the book, about the glorious 30. And I'll get back to culture in a minute, but why those years were so glorious was first economic prosperity. So by any measure, economic growth, inflation, unemployment, particularly the relationship between inflation and unemployment, productivity growth, the growth of real wages, the growth of real family income, all of those best 30 years, you know, that's just a fact. But another fact is that prosperity, those great economic numbers, were shared in a way that they never had been before and they never have been since. So that there was wage compression, so that the lower wage workers from a lower base increased more on a percentage base than higher wage workers. So that's Claudia Golden calls this the age of wage compression. I think it's Claudia. But also family incomes, real family income, that is inflation-adjusted incomes, increased more, not a lot more, but somewhat more at the bottom 20%, again from a lower base, than at the top 20%. So you had, over that 30 years, an equalizing of conditions of life. So number one of the gold of the golden age is shared prosperity. And within that, I focus on two elements that I think are key to working class life advancing. And that is the increase in discretionary income and discretionary time, or free time for what you will. Discretionary income often is misused, so I'm going to explain it. Disposable income is the money you have after taxes. Discretionary income is the money you have after taxes and all your other expenses. For most of human history, certainly for most of US history, most people did not have any discretionary income. You know, just meeting your bills is about what you could do, and often you didn't do that. You had to move to get away from your debts and things. So there's two things that happened during the Glorious 30. One, more and more people, eventually a majority, have discretionary income. And of those who have discretionary income, it grows slowly, little by little. But over that 30 years, real wages, for example, doubled. Real family incomes at the median, more than doubled. So this is a huge increase, I argue, in human freedom. If you have money that you can decide how to spend, that's what discretionary income is. Everything else, I just have to, you know, it's scripted for me. I cannot not pay the utility bill, et cetera. But discretionary income, and there's this big critique of consumerism and all of that. But this is pretty new in human history, that a majority of people can actually decide how to spend some of their money. The increase in free time for what you will is a little less dramatic, but I thought the weekend had been there since the Bible, you know, biblical times, and only to discover that the beginning of the weekend as a standard work week was the fall of 1945, after the war was over. The Fair Labor Standards Act was passed in the late 30s to declare the 40-hour week, but the war had so much overtime that the average work week was actually 48 hours, but with the significant difference that 8 of those hours were paid time and a half. So the weekend becomes a standard way of organizing your life, which it didn't work in steel towns because everybody had crazy schedules, but standard way of living your life only in the fall of 1945. And you could say it kicks off the Glorious 30. Not a lot of progress was made. The work week is the same now as it was then, the official work week. But unions added all kinds of holidays and various ways of having more time off, 30 and out. But the main increase in time for what you will was the creation of a whole new stage of life, namely retirement. People in 1945, there wasn't retirement. I mean, very few people had retirement, or retirement was a burden on the family. It wasn't a stage of life. One, most people didn't live to be 65. That's why Social Security established 65 at the cutoff. But also there's health. It isn't just Social Security and union pensions and things like that. It is all those things, but it's also greater longevity and what happened in medicine, et cetera. But think about a huge thing that is. I'm 78 years old, and I've been living 15 years without having to work. Now, that's something that could not have been imagined in 1945. And it isn't that unusual. I have a higher standard of living than my steelworker brother-in-laws. But they've lived a long time, too, without having to work. So that's a pretty huge piece of gold that we are in fact losing. There'll be fewer. Someone who's going into the workforce today, their chances of having anything like a retirement that a low paid steelworker had are slim and none, unless things are changed. The other. So I think those are things that this audience would all pretty much know and maybe not think about this part or that part. But the other part is widely unrecognized, including by us progressives and people related to the labor movement. And that is that these 30 years, 45 to 75, were a golden age of collective action. Now, that strikes some people as crazy because they think of the Glorious 30 as the 1950s. And they think of the 1950s as this conformist, placid time when nothing happened. But look at what decade saw more strikes, saw more people involved in those strikes, saw more major strikes and more work time lost than any other decade in American history. And it's the 1950s. Now, it's not distinctive because nobody got shot in the back. Nobody got bludgeoned by the coal and iron police. Very few places ran scabs or even thought of running scabs. But there were lots of strikes that both the people on the strikes and the people who could see those strikes saw, hey, organized collective action pays off. And if we underestimate, as I think often we do, the improvements that were made contract by contract, how they accumulated and how they changed people's lives, then we'll see a labor movement that's just bureaucratic and lost its militancy, bogged down by a grievance procedure, all of which is true. But meantime, all these huge improvements are being made based on organized collective action that is often highly visible to everybody in society. We see strikes today, and now recently they've gotten some reporting, but in the 1950s, they were all over the front pages. They were, yeah, Carol shaking her head because she followed the photographs and stuff. So that's the labor movement. But look at other social movements. 1955 to 1968, right in the heart of the Glorious 30, is the heyday of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, these were terrible times for Blacks, particularly in the South, but everywhere. But this is when things turned. This is when the arc of history turned on racism in the United States. I didn't turn enough, but boy, it turned pretty dramatically. In June of every year, we celebrate Pride Day, Gay Pride Day. That's because in June of 1969, the Stonewall riots set off gay liberation, which had started in a more polite form in the 50s. The Mattachine Society was formed in 1950, but the Stonewall started a whole different kind of gay rights movement. The women's movement, and I'm just touching on the most important, the women's movement doesn't have a clear date like that, but second wave feminism certainly occurs during this period. Betty Friedan is cooking up her book that had such an enormous impact in the 50s. And then second wave feminism really begins in the 60s, even though most of its accomplishments are outside the period of 45 to 75, which is true of all these movements except the labor movement. Some of the best accomplishments were outside this period. But the turn, the move toward organized collective action was then. And then there's the farm workers, the Chicano movement, disabled people, one movement after another that began during this period. So this is not recognized as a golden age of collective action, but it was. And I think if you take a minute to think about it, you'll see that. The third piece of what's gold, and what I think we can learn by looking at those 30 years, is that one of these is the cause of the other. And that is shared economic prosperity is a cause, a foundational, conditional cause of organized collective action. Now, that seems counterintuitive because of the old prejudice that the worse things get, the more likely there is to be reaction. I don't think history has worked that way for very seldom, very seldom. And I use this quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, where he said, and some of you will know this quote, it's actually a series of things, but he says, the most dangerous time for an oppressive government is when it starts to lift the oppression. Because once one injustice is corrected, people start to see other injustices that, hey, they might be corrected or modified or ameliorated. And they also have a stronger feeling that they should be corrected. So, and this is, I think, a pretty direct quote from Tocqueville, where he says, although life is getting better, our sensitivities are more acute. And so it's this sense of as things change, as they get better, our expectations grow, which is always going to be a problem for governments. But for the advancement of bending that arc, the arc of history toward justice, that's how things happen. Once possibilities emerge, once people can see, look what organized collective action accomplished here, their own sense of possibility and what they may be able to do expands. And I could, I'm not sure when I started, let me get the clock here. I could give some historical examples, but most people think of the Great Depression and think, well, the Great Depression, things were terrible, and that's when things changed for the labor movement. And broadly, that's true. But look at the specific timing. From 1929 to 1932, things got worse year by year by year. And though there was some creative tenant and unemployed organizing, mostly by the Communist Party, during that period, no upsurge. Roosevelt comes in, starts the New Deal, changes sense of the first 100 days, changes the sense of possibility in the summer of 1938, and some laws like the National Industrial Recovery Act. And the summer of 1934, strikes just explode. coming out of desperation of those 4 years from 29 to 32? Absolutely. But only when that sense of possibility was increased. And I make the same argument about the 1937 sit-downs initiated an explosion of sense that people could, explosion of people wanting to be and working to be in unions. Now, the rest of 37 wasn't that great, but things recovered in 38 and 39, and there was a sense of possibility based on that auto strike to a large extent. So that's the historical connection I see, and I think the Glorious 30 bears that out. Now, what does all this have to do with culture, with class cultures? One, I argue, somewhere between argue and presume, that the cultures, the class cultures, are the same now as they were at the kind of basic level that I'm talking about. They're the same now as they were in 1945. And that goes against some observation that working class culture has disappeared. And that used to be a vital working class culture with ethnic lodges and unions and churches and all that. And all of that's true. But there's a basic culture there that's the same now as it was then. However, middle class is a little more complicated, but however, cultures, the way they're lived in and practiced and the impact they have is shaped by economic circumstances. And one of the things I try to show in the book, but with most of the emphasis being on the Glorious 30, was how the two cultures, the two class cultures, both flourished and in a sense bloomed during the Glorious 30. They were the best of themselves. And I clearly make that argument, but also how they interacted with each other, how they influenced one another. And if you think about it, you know, and I have a class on a chapter on the working class and a chapter on the professional middle class. Not recognized enough, as far as I'm concerned, is the rise of the professional middle class. Just professional and managerial workers. They go from 5 million in 1940 to 25 million in 1980, from 11% of the workforce to 26% of the workforce now. They're almost 40%, not now, excuse me, 26% in 1980 in that period. This huge increase in professional middle class jobs. And I go through, and it includes artists and art teachers, literature professors, physics, you know, everything you can think of in the middle class. It just grows like crazy, much more than the workforce as a whole. Where do those people come from? They came from places like me. They came from the working class. Professors in the 1970s, 25% were from the working class. That's still the same today, no new progress. So the middle class during this period of the professional middle class, during this period of expansion, huge expansion, was influenced by working class people with working class culture coming into it. You know, blue jeans, if nothing else, rock and roll. You know, just a lot of ways that when working class culture was blooming, it affected the development of middle class culture. But conversely, so did middle class. Middle class education, people start finishing high school for one thing, and more people go to college, and that's literally teaching middle class ways and middle class culture. And there's other kinds of exposures and interactions. So I try to contrast that to today, when because there is less, much less, equality of condition between the middle class and the working class, there is less interaction, more isolation between the cultures. And this leads to, you know, on the political front, more rigid stereotypes of each other. They have this inclination to think we're not real, or maybe just not real Americans. And we have this inclination to think that they're just backward and ignorant, and need to try harder to become more like us. So with those kinds of rigid stereotypes, lack of knowledge, lack of real knowledge based on direct experience of each other, that has cultural, political, as well as cultural effects over time. But the isolation also, I don't want to say degrades the cultures, but makes both cultures narrower, more cramped, and in different ways, more crabby. And if, in a sense, the two cultures have become and are becoming more extreme versions of themselves, because the lack of interaction, they're losing some balance. And some people will recognize the critique of middle-class child rearing, which to those of us who grew up in a different time and who grew up working class, seems like prison for, you know, that the kids at 4 years old, they start learning algebra and stuff. And, you know, and everything is standardized test things for the rest of their life so that they can become part of the exam passing classes. And this is the worst part, is as this gap grows between working class conditions and professional middle class conditions, and the only way to get into the professional middle class or to stay in it is to get a college degree. And the better college, the better the job you'll have, the more prospects you have. But meanwhile, working class life is sinking, so that the fear of falling in the middle class becomes, and it's not a fear, it's anxiety. It's, you know, it's terror. And I have two grandsons in their early 20s, both college graduates. And I feel that terror too. You know, they're right at the point where they should be getting decent jobs. The one's a waiter and he's a MMA fighter. And the other is unemployed still. He just graduated recently. And it is, you know, when you see what working class life has become and that distance, that's undermining middle class life, and it's undermining middle class culture. We're not as good as we can be in more equal conditions. So that's it. I'm not sure how long I've talked, but I think I'm about right. I have some more I could say, but I think I'll end it at that.
Well, and it very well may be, Jack, that it comes up in the Q&A in terms of the things that you were going to add. I'm going to open it up for discussion, and if people would raise their hands, that would be great. And I know that Tom Carr and others were putting stuff, I believe, in the chat that they might want to say out loud, just so that you can react to that. But let me put you on, that's the first thing is, just would you talk for 2 seconds about the fact that I think that the distillation of class that you're using is that middle class has a tendency to be aspirational, whereas the working class has a tendency to be living in the present and very place-based. And so that aspirational thing, just in relation to your grandsons, is it that they have aspirations, but their aspirations very well may not be met. So that there is kind of a crisis of expectations, I think, that you're laying out, which is part and parcel. But what you're saying is that crisis of expectation is being owned by them individually, whereas before, a crisis of expectations was being owned collectively. Is that fair in terms of how you're laying it out, Jack?
Well, and let's think about that, John, individually and collectively. That part fooled me right at the end. And I don't really know how to answer that. I do think, and don't get me talking about my grandsons. And my wife and I spent a lot of time as the secondary parents or the babysitters. But there's this sense in a terrific article by a Duke sociologist named Jesse Strive, a friend of mine. And she shows with empirical research, but it just makes sense, I think checks out anyway, that people raised in a comfortable professional middle class setting where they went to a high school where almost everybody went to college, and then they went to college with people who were all mostly from professional middle class backgrounds, that their life from a child through college in some ways is they are the center of things. Everything, the family, school, college, is built around serving them. And then they're expected to get a job where they are no longer the center of things. In fact, they're not even important. And those are professional jobs as well. And the question Jesse raises, how is it that you expect young adults raised this way to make this adjustment? Now, in fact, they do make the adjustment, but there is that personal dilemma that my grandsons who fulfill those qualifications, middle class high school, middle class college, et cetera. That is individually what they're working their way through, and we're all worried that they won't, you know. And I think that's very common in middle class life.
So let me open it up, Jack. So Tom, you have your hand up. You're muted, Tom. Tom, you're muted. Tom, you're muted.
I went the wrong way. I did put a couple of things in the chat, but they're just little questions that came along the way. I'd like to add to, I guess, your commentary about the characteristics of working class culture that are strong positives, at least as I understood it, given my own upbringing and background, and the impact of separation and of isolation of these two cultures, as you put it, from one another. As context, let me tell you where my parents came from. My dad was a red dirt farmer and grew up in middle Georgia, became the head of his family at age 13 when his dad died, and was running that family through the Depression. He and my uncle, my dad's little brother, did things like load watermelons onto railroad cars to send them up to folks in New York who still had money to buy watermelons, and use their mules to drag pine trees out of the Georgia swamps and stuff like that. My mom grew up on a considerably more prosperous farm, but they were not plantation owners or anything like that in Georgia. They met at Oak Ridge during World War II, but neither one of them was a big time scientist. Neither one of them had a fancy education by that point. My dad worked on the uranium production lines, and my mom was a lab tech in a chemistry lab. After the war, the guy that was my dad's boss on the uranium production lines offered him a job at a chemical plant up in Ohio that this guy had been sent to get started. So my dad went, because of World War II, from this depressingly working class, farm-based kind of background, to a middle-class manager kind of job. He was a middle-level manager at a chemical plant for the whole life that I knew him. Okay. And my mom had similarly, similar kind of upbringing, just a little more money in the family. So in that context, what I learned as a part of what I think was a clearly a working class kind of culture, but with a middle class lifestyle, like you're talking about, was, in addition to the things you talked about, a really strong work ethic and a sense of responsibility, a responsibility to your duties in life that would often take precedence over any of your personal whims or your self-aggrandizements and so forth. And that just, they didn't beat it into me. It just permeated the way they both lived their lives. Okay, so my dad was regarded as an awfully good manager by the guys that, and it was mostly guys that worked for him. And he would tell me stories about how things changed when that plant unionized, which was either in the late 50s or the very early 60s. Prior to unionization, people's cars looked pretty much the same, and everybody ate in the cafeteria together, and dad would be out on the gangways, helping the plumbers fix pipes, and he knew all the workers by first names. After unionization, there was a growing division between the managers and a growing sense of confrontation and division of labor between the managers and the workers. So that, you know, when my dad climbed up one time and there was a pump that had broken and was spewing polyvinyl chloride slurry all over the place. And there was a big wrench right there, and he could have closed it himself, which he would have done until a couple of plumbers got there, but he couldn't, because then he'd get a union grievance filed against him. So he had to call and wait for the plumbers to come 15 minutes across the plant and so forth and so on. So there was a downside in his life, which had very practical consequences. It hurt him both because of this sense of duty, but also because he'd lost this sense of we're all in this together and collegiality. That was also an important thing to him. I guess that went along with this collective action thing. So here's two ways of being collective that fought against each other. So I've talked a really long time, but there were two or three themes in my life history that really resonated with the things you were talking about. And I wonder if any of that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, it does. and it's a hell of a story. Well told. Thank you for doing that. I'm going to pick up on the duty and hard work part, because that's definitely the working class that I grew up in as well. That, to me, is embodied in the sense of character. That, and I talk about grinders, about role players, people seeing themselves as role players, holding up their end, doing their bit, not being outstanding, which is important in middle class life, to be outstanding, to be extraordinary, or to try to be. And so that sense of duty and the work ethic, that's part of working class character. However, people, not all working class people or working class culture focus just on those things, or today have such a strong sense of duty, but they have ever other senses of character that are primary to them and more important than accomplishing things that you can put on a resume. I think that's particularly characteristic of industrial work, the hard work. And I have a chapter in the book called Taking It. And that's a working class characteristic that has the sense that there's just a part of life that's going to be hard and miserable, and you just have to be able to take it. And it's not easy to take it, but you have to take it. And that's a necessary part of life in order to have the good parts. But I think the duty and the hard work though very important, is wrapped, for me, is wrapped into that emphasis on character. And there are working class, particularly males, much less so and with much more stigma among females, whose sense of character is more free-spirited than that sense of duty and industriousness and sticking to it and taking it. And sometimes those people are, they end up having not such good lives, but their sense of what character is different. So I try to, there's just a lot of variation in terms of what people see as good character. And important gender differences as well.
Now, I've got a number of questions, Jack, but I still want to see other hands around the room or other comments that folks have before I pepper you with a couple. Sandy. And then Sam. Sandy, you're muted.
Thank you, John. I recently finished Michael Sandel's book, Tyranny of Merit, and his discussion is about social division that you have well described between the middle class cultures. He ends the book by saying we need to interact more because we don't really interact with one another in public spaces very much anymore. The other thing he says, which is very important to me, is that how few people who start out in poverty actually get out of poverty. He cites 1 in 5, 20%. There's a current emphasis on people not getting four-year degrees, but becoming skilled workers through community college. Put all this together. Trump won an election by dividing people in many respects. It seems to me we ought to get together. But Sandel in his book doesn't tell us how to do it. And you're still describing two different groups of people that don't see things the same way. As a culture, it seems to me, we've got to get beyond that. Where's the sweet spot?
Let me ask Sam and Carol to actually put their questions or comments out right now, and then Jack can react to all three. Sam?
Excuse me. So my question was just on, what do you think social media's current influence on the relationship between working and middle class cultures has come to? So with the rise of Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and the like, being able to see much more easily into people's homes and what they're like, regardless of class, and you see things going viral or people that you are different videos and pictures and things of that nature, regardless of class, just based on entertainment purposes. So I was curious to see your thoughts on how social media has affected more recently the relationship between working and middle class.
Carol?
I'm not sure I know how to formulate this as well as I would like to, but you didn't speak about race all that much. And on the one hand, we can see the really strong support that the labor movement gave to the civil rights movement, from the 50s onward. On the other hand, you can see the real racism that resides in a lot of working class communities, including the one that I grew up in, that is virulent. Now, I don't happen personally to think that it's all that different in middle class culture, but I do think it's really strong in working class culture. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about this link that you're trying to draw between the civil rights movement and this golden era, because I can see how you're doing it, but I have a lot of questions about it too.
Okay, Jack, you want to take on those three?
I only have 15 minutes left, right?
We can go long if we have to, Jack. We can order out dinner.
Really tough questions. On Sandel's book, Tyranny of Merit, I've read it, and it's a really great book. I And in some ways, his critique of meritocracy, which I think is overdone, but is similar to the way I place achievement ideology within middle-class culture. And it really is a bad aspect of our culture that there's all this talk about achieving excellence, about being outstanding, about being extraordinary. And what that means, the introduction to my book is called Achieving Mediocrity, and I explain what that means. But this achievement ideology that we should be outstanding, extraordinary, you know, that's pretty hard to be. And what it means is I not only have to be better than somebody else, in order to be excellent, I have to be better than almost everybody else. And that's a very foolish aspiration and a potentially toxic one within middle class life. And so I really agree with Sandel about that. The policy, the note I took, Sandy, is the policy sweet spot, I'm very clear on. What you have to do is increase discretionary income and free time for what you will. That's the goal. And you have to do that on a steady basis. And when you look at it, there's no way to do that substantially and over time without a wealth tax that funds a much enhanced social wage. There are ways you can increase market wages, but there's limits there because there's a lot of unskilled work that all kinds of people can do. So there's an oversupply of workers usually, not right now. And so wages in some areas, you just can't raise much on the market basis. So you need stronger unions, higher minimum wage. There are some things that you can improve the market wage, but you also need a wealth tax, which of course is Piketty's and Elizabeth Warren's hobby horse, to fund social wages like the child tax credit, like the pre-K, like the subsidizing of daycare, which I figured for one of my nieces, grandnieces, she's a assistant manager at a Walmart. She makes about $45,000 a year. Those three things that were part of the original Build Back Better would increase her spending power by $14,000 a year. So roughly to go from $45,000 to $60,000 a year. And it, as it turns out, well, it's more complicated than that. But that's a huge, just those things. And that's what I call a social wage, not a social safety net, because nobody's fallen anyplace to be captured by it. So that's a social wage. And we are blessed to have this oversupply of wealthy people. We can tax them just a little bit and change millions and millions and millions of working class lives. So that's the policy sweet spot. Social media impact, I'm probably the last person to answer on that, except the way you posed that, I think was really interesting to me, and I've never thought of it that way. There is class interaction through social media. Some of that's pretty nasty, and my wife got in trouble with her siblings, her working class siblings, over arguing about Trump and who is really evil, them or us. So it's not, you know, and it's not a good, as far as I can see, it's not a good way of communicating and interacting. It's not the most desirable way versus actually doing things together and having real instead of string conversation. But in fact, you make me think, you know, this is one way that we've been through Facebook. We've been keeping up with the working class parts of our family and what's happening to their kids and things like that, which even before COVID, we were becoming more and more isolated from. So may, that's just something that I think I should think more about. Not that I spend that much time on social media, but something may be happening there that I'm not seeing. Carol, on race, what you said that there was a lot of working class racism, and you qualified that, that you think there's a lot of middle class racism too, particularly in when you were growing up and when I was growing up. But that presumes that you're talking about only the white part of the working class, and I'm not. 40% of the working class is people of color, mostly Blacks and Hispanics. So it's hard for me the claim I'm making is that the culture I'm talking about is not the culture of the white working class. It's the culture of the working class. And I try to isolate the claim. So I say at one point that the book is rigorously intersectional. And some people have thought, boy, that's a challenge. And are you challenged? No, I don't mean to challenge intersectionality. Intersectionality is really essential for understanding individuals and individual situations. And there's all kinds of other cultures besides the class cultures that affect our behavior and how we identify, et cetera, and our experience. But I'm trying to isolate the class cultures. So anything that I say about working class cultures, I mean to apply to Blacks and Latinos. Now, I need to point out, and this is a little embarrassing, but I taught at a university where half my students were, it was half Black and white, all kinds of different ages, and they were adults, not kids. So I feel many Blacks in Chicago think that where I taught, Roosevelt University, is an historically Black institution. And that's because in 1945, we were one of the first universities to admit Blacks and not to have quotas against Blacks and Jews, or Catholics for that matter. So I feel like I have enough experience across racial lines, less with the Latino and Latinas than with Blacks, but including where I live and who my son and grandsons grew up with, et cetera, that, I'm open to people saying, well, it's not this way for a Polish family, or it's not this way for a Black family, or something like that. But the intention is that I'm covering the whole working class as a class, that part of the culture. I do think many people balk at the Glorious 30 being glorious when they look at conditions of African-Americans in those days. And that's true. This is not a time that you'd want to go back to in any way, shape, or form. But Black family incomes and wages went up more for Blacks than for white people from a lower base. And so there was some compression. So for family incomes, I think it went from the median real family income for Blacks was 55% of what it was for whites. And whites are much bigger. And so there's a lot of rich people included in that, on that median. So you're not just comparing Black working class and white working class. But it went from 55% to 61%. It hasn't advanced in 1975. It hadn't advanced since then. It's now about 57%. So the Black experience was there were these years of improvement, greater sense of possibility, that I argued helped fuel the civil rights movement, and that since the Glorious 30, real material life has declined up for the working class. Blacks in the professional middle class, I think, have tripled their percentage or something. There's been real progress there, but things are worse for the Black working class now than they were in 1975.
So, Jack, if it's okay, I'm going to ask you if you'd be willing to stay on an additional 15 minutes if people want to stick with us.
Sure.
Because, good. Just so that people not
have. I'm a retiree. I have nothing to do.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to go there. But let me raise something that might be close to the heart of others as well. That is that I cut my teeth on Sennett and Cobb's Hidden Injuries of Class back in 1972. And the importance of that book talking to me about my own working class background was about the double bind psychologically of what happens to working class kids when they go to college, because the fact that their parents often were pushing aspiration on them, saying, kid, you have to do better than we did, and that you have to go on to, therefore, to higher education. And it creates that whole problem of having a foot in each and not necessarily fitting in each. That is that notion of being a pretender, okay? And that, you know, that feeling that you have a vocabulary that your parents can now not understand, at the same time as you are not of the same class as many of the people that you're sitting side by side in higher education. And I think Sennett and Cobb were very interested in that kind of double bind, as they talked about it, because of the fact that it's a psychological contract that we get into. That is that when, if we leave our working class community, that settled community, I think that you're really saying is the carrier of the culture, that it becomes a situation where it's place-based. So if you look at what's happened to so many families, people are all over hell's half acre now in terms of very rare that we stay in our own hometowns. I mean, there's a lot of change. So could you talk a little bit about that whole notion of being one foot in, one foot out? And just one last thing, my colleague and Kurt's colleague, Yvonne Lockwood, always pointed out to me, she said, John, you will never stop being working class, but your children will never be working class. That is because of the fact that you don't inherit working class as much as you have to live in it, rather than even if you leave it. So comments on any of that, Jack?
Well, there's two things there. I don't want to forget the second one about your children will never be working class, because I disagree with that. What was the first one?
Talk to me about double binds
in both worlds. Sennett and Cobb, you know, was very important to me as well. I have some criticisms of it now after all these years, but it was really eye-opening, as well as work by Lillian Rubin, similar time period in the 70s. but this... there's this rich literature about working class academics.
Yeah.
And I've read a lot of it. I never studied it. Barbara Jensen actually studied it for like a year and coded stuff and things. But it's so varied. And how people experience those two worlds and how we handle them is just so various. So it depends on where you come from in the working class. And I've never had sympathy for working class people from working class backgrounds who become hyper middle class. But then you talk to them, and some of them, you know, they grew up in really shitty families with a father who wasn't there and a mother who didn't love them. You know, they were just so that's part of the working class too. And you know, I can understand why you would want to do nothing but run away from that. Other people were very attached. You know, that we develop a middle class gloss, but there's this fierce attachment to a mother or to parents, but most often it's a mother. And to the siblings that are working class. So there's this wide variety of things. But I think within that experience what I tried to do, drawing on my own experience, but also on that literature, and on hours, maybe decades of talks with other academics from working class backgrounds, try to, what is it that's complicating things for us? How to put a name on it? And I'm not convinced I've done that perfectly, but I think I've done it well enough to have another generation who still is experiencing the same thing that you and I experienced at a different time, first gen students, putting name on things can help clarify and then develop thinking as they go along. On the question of whether our children can be working class, cultures are sticky. And I didn't mean to, but my wife, who's also from a working class background, I would call my experience from a settled living working class. She was from a hard living working class. And, you know, we were high school sweethearts, junior high school sweethearts. We didn't mean to raise our son. We just have the one son, working class. And he became a very successful middle-class professional, but he has all kinds of working-class ways about him. And even the grandsons, and he married a woman who was from a working-class background and also has working-class ways about it. So some of that got transferred to the grandsons. So I mentioned one of them, and I'm very proud of this. He's an MMA fighter. He's 4-0. He's ranked number 4 in the state of Ohio among amateur lightweights. One, because if you've ever seen these MMA fights where they're in cages and stuff, it's like, you know, you just getting in there, you got to get some credit. But that's part of his, he doesn't want to work in a cubicle. He doesn't want to work, that's it, that's his expression. And what he means is he doesn't want an office job. And where does that come from? So, you know, these transfers, these cultural transfers occur whether we mean them to or not. And from my lights, but the interpretation that's in the book, this is a good thing. You know, these cultures need to inform each other. And as individuals, we're in a better situation if we can mix and match. Take parts from what we think are the good parts of each culture, not with a balance, not with a synthesis or anything like that, but just both of them being available to us, which you and I, John, they have been.
So other folks who want to jump in, especially those who haven't had a chance to ask a question or make a comment yet. Any others or other people who want to just talk again about a point or raise any further question?
Lou, do you have a question?
Sure, I'll ask one. I've been thinking that this year is sort of a year of union activity and union organizing and some of it in the middle class, you know. In Pittsburgh, grad students, some professors and museum workers, librarians, Google contract workers have all organized. And I've been trying to match up, you know, the cultures that you're outlining with this year of union activity. And I wonder if you've given some thought to those kinds of questions.
I have. And I actually try to, not so much in the book, but other places I have, try to appeal to the professional middle class, our history of collective action. The most unionized occupation is teachers, who by my, those are professional middle class jobs. That's the way the BLS characterizes them. And a lot of the leadership of the strikes of the last several years has come from teachers unions. So there is a way, you know, my big sense is that I make a distinction in the professional middle class between a couple different distinctions, but one is between the elite and what I call the standard issue middle class. Most of us are standard issue middle class that in midlife, we discover that we're not going to be great. We're not going to be outstanding. We're not going to be excellent. So what do? You know, that's a time to be have some exposure to working class culture and the sense of how fulfilling it can be to just do your craft, whatever it is, well, as a middle class professional. So there's a lot of more overlap between the standard issue middle class and the settled living working class, and also the hard living, because we're very often the professionals who are dealing with the problems, trying to help hard living or poor people. So it's really those two segments, the settled living and the settled living working class and the standard issue middle class, that have so much in common, including a tradition of unionism and collective action, that I can see a class coalition, a coalition of interests being built.
You know, one thing just to mention, Jack, that I think that this also brings up is that during that golden age that you were talking about, the most significant thing that happened that kept the labor movement vibrant was the rise of public sector unions. Uh-huh. You know, both with the Kennedy's executive order to allow federal workers to organize on the one side, but the rise of state by state collective bargaining acts starting in Illinois, right, into Michigan and the rest. And right, the public sector still is about 37% organized compared to the private sector, which is only about 7 to 8% organized. So in that golden age, that is the most significant thing I think that happened in terms of organization,
right,
was that rise, right?
Right, right. And public sector, much greater mix of black and white, yeah, and most of those public sector unions couldn't advance with allowing the kind of white racism that often was in the industrial.
So Tom?
Yeah, since you're back to the golden age, I'll ask a question that was that I did put in the chat. Since on the surface, or according to the stereotypes and so forth, there are a lot of differences between French culture and American culture. I'm curious about what the French thought were the great characteristics that led them to coin the phrase golden age to begin with, and were they pretty much the same as what we thought or different from one another? And did you end up sort of having to mush across some differences, or was it really pretty much the same?
It's not just the French. All of Europe looks at that 30 years. The Soviet Union, that was the best 30 years for the Soviet Union. This was the period of post-war prosperity. Now, most European countries would not start it in 45. They'd start it in 52 or 55, something like that. But their rebuilding process and installation of a welfare state, but not only a welfare state, a social wage. So these were the years when progress was made in France. Now, I don't know, basically I'm just using the phrase. The book that coined that phrase has never been translated into English. And there was a time when I could read French, but that time has passed. So I haven't actually read the book. So I'm just using the phrase, but I think it's pretty interesting why I use it. Because glorious 30, you know, this is the period often called post-war prosperity, dated differently. But glorious 30, glorious, like, seems over the top. Really good time, prospered, peace, you know, but glorious, that's not something English language speakers are inclined to use about anything. So it makes it a higher level of requires a higher level of evidence to defend Glorious than it would, you know, the really good 30 years or something like that.
Okay. Any other questions that haven't been raised or people that want to jump in one way or the other? Glenda was loving the fact that you share a birth date, I think, if I got that right, Glenda. other things that...
1943, one of the bloodiest years in world history.
Other things that that people want to raise one way or the other. By the way, just Carol, I think you want to, or was that waving goodbye?
No, actually, again, this might be a comment, but I'm really interested in the culture of class and the way it's transmitted. And this idea that there was a lot of solidarity from, let's say, the 30s, maybe through the 60s or 70s, and thinking about both the Popular Front and also government commissioning of culture, that really seems fruitfully to explain a lot. And then I'm really curious about this later period then, like, let's say, from the 70s through the 90s. Did you look at that at all? Or it sounded a lot like Denning to me, Michael Denning's argument in the cultural front.
Okay, my sense of culture is just the anthropological sense as a way of life. And part of that is because working class cultural expression is so complicated, on a class basis. Most of us who express working class, tell working class stories, that we're no longer working class. So that makes it complicated. But no, I'm just talking about cultures as ways of life, as cultures inform the way people should, they're outside, like a way of life, imbibed, you know, through your upbringing and later. But they inform, guide, nudge, push, shove us in various directions and expectations and how we should live a life.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Jack, first of all, for spending an extra 15 minutes with us. And it's great to see
you. Well, that was time and a half, right?
Huh?
I'm going to get paid time and a half for that.
Yeah. In fact, I promise you, I'll give you double time compared to what I'm already paying you for this, Jack.
Okay. So thanks everybody for coming and such good questions. And thanks, John.
And there's a lot of stuff to explore, Jack. You and I have to probably belly up to the bar, and I'm able to belly more than you are up to the bar. But,
you've been seeing my belly recently.
well, then we'll compare. But the point, I think the question that Carol raised, I think there have been a number of questions about the difference between lived experience of class and also kind of the artifacts of class. That is, as people leave a class, what do they take with them? Mm-hmm. And also descriptions of class and images of class. And how those resonate with people. So there's a lot of stuff to explore. And yeah. So we look forward to exploring that with you. I think everyone had a great time today. Thank you for coming. And do come back and hear about our company union at Goodrich back in the day. And okay. Thanks for being part of our daily work, our daily lives.